From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Two of the smartest shows on TV that also happen to be incredibly funny, a rare combination, come from the mind of my guest today, co-creator of the show Sherman's Showcase and Southside, two shows that are alliterative, I guess. That's what brings them here. Diallo Riddle is back. Diallo Riddle, thank you so much for doing the show again.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's funny you bring that up because anytime my writing partner and I use shorthand to talk about the shows, we try to just do SS and it just adds to the confusion.
Let's start first talking about Southside, which is, it's the kind of thing that I don't want to call it any other shows, but it doesn't take seriously what other shows about the Black experience in contemporary terms take seriously. But it's also incredibly well acted. I mean, usually that kind of thing is done, played in sketch terms. And they're real performances. And I was just sort of thinking, and I don't want to give too much away, but the first and last episodes of the season start with looks at the street, but in very different ways.
Look, we have a lot of really well-trained actors on the show. Like, it's funny. Our show is sort of like the extreme. Some of our cast members have never really had acting experience on other shows, and that's because we intentionally pluck people from the South Side of Chicago who we think are funny. You know, if anything, we just coach them to play themselves. So, for example, in the very first episode, we have a scene with the guy who sells the ices, and that's what that guy really did. He sells snow cones in real life. So, in that sense, some of our actors have never really acted before, but they bring a certain authenticity that you don't get when you fly in a bunch of professionally trained actors from LA. At the same time, Bashir, who plays Officer Goodnight, Chandra, his real life wife, who plays Officer Turner, these are people who have gone to real acting school and, you know, not even just like the acting schools that we do here in LA, but like studied in college. And so they bring a different level of acting to it. So I appreciate that you sort of recognize that we come at, you know, the streets of the South Side of Chicago, both realistically, but also with our own sort of, you know, jaundiced by years of watching The Simpsons sort of attitude.
The Simpsons, but also, I mean, I can't help but think that between these two shows, but especially Sherman's Showcase, that SCTV and that what Melonville wasn't some kind of influence in the kind of world that you and Bashir, we say your partner.
Bashir Salahuddin. In a weird way, Sherman's Showcase is like our ideal salon. You know, like a salon in the sense of like 1920s Berlin or, like it really is our, 1990 Seattle. It really is our chance to bring in everybody who we think is interesting or funny or just it's almost like a yearbook scrapbook, if you will. Somebody just this morning, my brother sends me a picture of an event at Mr. Chow in 1986. And in the picture, you've got Basquiat, Keith Haring, Grace Jones, and Fela Kuti all within, like, it looks like the DJ booth. And you're just like, man, I wish I could be at that party. And I feel like that's the vibe that we try to create at Sherman's Showcase. So you'll see Bashir in a scene with Lil Rel and Fonte Coleman from the rap group Lil Brother, who does a lot of the music for the show, and John Legend and Common and Quincy Jones. Like, we're sort of trying to have our own Mr. Chow 1986 DJ moment every time that we shoot Sherman Showcase, because we want people to watch it now, obviously, but also look back and be like, man, all those people were, you know, hanging out and being creative and coming up with what's the craziest next thing that can happen in this sketch or in this scene.
It's interesting, too, because I think that sort of connects the two shows is the sort of almost epic pettiness of a lot of the people.
We don't have a very high impression of humanity. I will agree. I do feel like humanity is funnier when you're seeing the flaws, and especially with our two main characters on Southside, my character who plays a politician, Alderman Alan Gale, and with Bashir's Officer Goodnight, we really do try to treat them like Job. We try and throw as many obstacles and as many rocks in their way as possible and just see what happens. I mean, like we're downright cruel.
But I mean, it's funny because this season starts off the sort of cruelty that you built to in the first season. The first episode begins with that. I mean, there's this whole conversation during a repossession about dreams that is almost like watching some version of Death of a Salesman. It's kind of extraordinary. And it could be played for tragedy, but it's incredibly funny because at no point is anybody doing the sort of things you see in a Wayans Brother film, which is not to castigate those movies. But again,
oh, you know, I'm friends with Marlon Wayans too.
That's why I'm not trying to give anything away. But you know, what I'm saying. That there's a level of reality that scene is very much about near the beginning of the first episode of this new season of Southside. That's just kind of, you laugh and it takes your breath away at the same time.
I would say that Bashir and I, we're big fans of gallows humor. You know, like we really like a good dark joke. And I think even when we were drafting the scene of the repossession, for those who don't know, if you have had the almost misfortune of having to ever deal with Rent-A-Center, well, on our show, we have a place called Rent-A-Own. And, you know, you'll basically rent a whole bunch of stuff for your house. And if at some point you don't pay it, they will come and repossess it. They call it a replevin. And we were like, let's start this season off, you know, just to remind people what the show is actually about. You know, it's a workplace comedy in a lot of ways. Let's remind people that replevins are, you know, sort of a very bleak thing. And you know, they come in and they take away, you know, this family's whole kitchen, which, again, does not sound funny. It actually sounds quite tragic. But I think there's just something about the way that our comedic brains work that, like, in most tragedies, there is some humor to be mined. You know, it's almost like that Q-Tip quote about, you know, you laugh to keep from crying. And I should also say that Bashir and I both come from very large Black families. That father is sort of like how I feel like my father and Bashir's father used to talk to us. You know what I mean? Like, there's a very sort of like, hey, we're going to go out there and we're going to make something of ourselves and we're going to believe in ourselves, right? Don't let anything stand in your way. And then, of course, one of the guys from RTO stands in his way. You know, I think that it's sort of pulling on our real life experiences growing up as working class people and then just trying to find the humor in not having a whole lot.
Well, I mean, the whole speech about what a credit score is maybe one of the most masterly pieces of comedy writing and to attempt to explain something to a child.
It's a dark magic, my friend. It's a dark magic. And by the way, you have to cut everything down for time. And I kind of wish we had left in more because he went on. We wrote a pretty long speech just about the credit score that we had to sharply cut down. But it begins with him saying, hey, name some magical, you know, imaginary things. And, you know, it was like everything from Wakanda, you know, to love. And then, you know, he then says that a credit score is, you know, a magical thing, too. And again, we grew up loving The Simpsons, loving just the idea of making comedy that could also have something to say about society. I think that, you know, social commentary, you know, my father was a painter. He always said that when he was in school, he would learn how to do the still life. But at the end of the day, especially after the Watts Rise, my father was of that generation. He was like, after the Watts Rise, he couldn't go back to painting pears. And I feel like our comedy, sort of taking from his inspiration, we can't just write a joke just because it's funny. Like, I think that's not actually true. We will definitely sell out an entire script for one joke. But I will say that, like, what makes us laugh are the things that we're exposed to. And we are definitely exposed to the state of the world as it is today.
It's the treatment. My guest, who has just sort of tied his career to Weimar Republic Germany, is Diallo Riddle. He's the co-creator of the show Southside and Sherman Showcase. Southside is on HBO.
I usually tie it to Alexis de Tocqueville because I always say that, you know, Bashir was from Chicago. I was not. But because I wasn't, I was able, you know, when we would drive around Chicago, I'd be like, oh, what is that? And then he would explain it to me and it would occur to him that, you know, when you go around someone else's hometown, you notice things that they just take for granted. And so in a weird way, because he knew the city so well and because I knew it not so well, we were able to figure out, well, what are the most interesting things about the city of Chicago and specifically about the South Side that would make for universally interesting television?
One of the things that makes that show, Sherman, so interesting is that there's a parody, and the movie parody is always pretty wonderful, but a Wes Anderson parody that's funny, A, because there are Black people in it, and B, that you realize you don't even see Black people in parodies of Wes Anderson movies. So that's an entirely Black cast in a Wes Anderson parody, and the Black experience is so removed from that you can name the three Black actors who've been in Wes Anderson movies.
I gotta say that I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan. I'm a huge Tim Burton fan. I've been watching Wednesday over this this month with my family, and it occurred to me that some of my favorite directors just, you know, I don't know if it's intentional, but they never ever have, you know, these black characters in the movies. And to a certain extent, Sherman Showcase, which we always say, look, if SNL is 30 Rock, if 30 Rock takes place at SNL, then our show takes place at Soul Train. That's what essentially the show's about, but the show's about a lot more. And part of what we love about Sherman Showcase is that it gives us a certain amount of wish fulfillment. So when we sit down in that room, we say, you know, what's something that, you know, all of us really, really love, and what would be our angle on it? And at some point I brought up the fact that I love Wes Anderson films. I've been a fan since Bottle Rocket, but I don't know if I'll ever end up in a Wes Anderson film because he doesn't seem to have too many black characters in his films. And when he does, you know, they're not always as, you know, as fun and as fleshed out as some of the other characters. And so we were like, well, why don't we make a Wes Anderson film? Separately, we had had a conversation about what, you know, because there was that whole thing about HBO having a show in development about what if the South had won, you know, the Civil War. And we were like, that's not the move. That's not the show I want to see. You know, I want to see the show where, like, after the Civil War, Reconstruction actually worked. And so we took that idea, and also my love of steampunk. I'm a big fan of steampunk, just as an aesthetic and Afrofuturism. I've always wanted to dabble in that area. We took, what if Reconstruction works so that every black person after slavery got 40 acres and a blimp? And so that is what allowed us to do a Wes Anderson film that, quite frankly, I would go see that whole movie. I mean, every now and then we do a sketch where I'm like, man, I kind of want somebody to finance the whole thing. Because, you know, you can see, like, from the actors to the whole thing was so much fun. It was like so many of our favorite things poured into one pot.
I mean, this isn't just a sketch, that parody. It's actually sort of built to feel as realistic as possible. And just the running thread of the Ocean's 11 parodies. This season, it's Diddy's 11.
which I thought was going to get us killed.
I cannot tell you that every time I say that title aloud, I start to tear up because it's so perfect. So much of what these shows are about, and I want to have you talk about that a little bit. Certainly all those women wanting to be heard. And you start from the center, which, and I'm not going to give anything away, which is to say, farther from the center, either on the left or the right, the level of obscurity tends to ratchet itself up exponentially, is the best way to describe it.
Well, like, look, I mean, I think it's pretty well, you know, from documentaries like Standing in the Shadows of Motown, like we sort of knew that there were a lot of artists who, I think it's fair to say, were disappointed in Berry Gordy's bookkeeping. And they felt like they didn't get credit. So we started off with Temptations 11, which was basically our take on Ocean's 11. And it was a bunch of Motown artists, everybody from Lionel Richie to Stevie Wonder. Like, everybody was, you know, going to pull a heist on Berry Gordy's house to try and get the money that they were owed in residuals. And we had a lot of fun with that. And we're not like SNL. We don't believe like we have to go back to the well if we, you know, we don't feel required, I should say, to go back to the well. But at some point, someone in the writer's room was like, you know, I kind of want to see us do Temptations 11 again, but this time with Bad Boy Records in the 90s. And I was like, well, you know, Berry Gordy is one thing, but Diddy's still very much alive and he will hurt us. But as people started to pitch more and more jokes on it, I was like, you know what, this is just funny. And, you know, honestly, this is something that we could literally sit down and laugh with, you know, with Diddy, if we, you know, ever sat down and laughed with him, if that was ever a thing. I want to take a step back and say that the whole reason Sherman Showcase exists is because Bashir and I started off our TV career in earnest on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, where we met the Roots. And back in those days, the writers would work daily with the Roots, and Questlove and I would get into conversations when we were supposed to be working. We would get into conversations about, like, okay, do you think that every song that ever made it to Sierra went through Rihanna first? Like, that was probably their first choice for that song, right? Like, it was just always like these jokes, and they were so inside baseball. They were so inside baseball on music. But in our show, the rapper Vic Mensa, who has an amazing Prince impression, plays Prince, and we chart his career from, like, when he's playing the keyboards on a song that's very similar to Stand Back by Stevie Nicks. And it's just to call out that story for the real music heads who know that, you know, Prince did play the keyboards on Stand Back. you know, then we get into his Purple Rain period where like everything that our character Charade, who's basically Prince, you know, everything he does is like pure magic. And then by 1993, he's coming on after a sort of Eric B and Rakim wannabe. And the crowd just wants more Eric B and Rakim. And they're not really checking for Prince because the times have moved on, even though he still plays 27 instruments and is brilliant. I mean, like, this is sort of a conversation on music played out through funny sketches, but it's the kind of conversation that I could, you know, as my verbosity shows, I could talk about for hours and we would laugh about in the writer's room for hours.
We'll take a break. I'll leave you with the words Danity Kane before the break. My guest is Diallo Riddle. He's the co-creator of Sherman Showcase and Southside is the Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. There's something we should talk about with my guest, Diallo Riddle, the co-creator of Sherman Showcase and Southside. And he also co-stars on both shows with his partner, Bashir Salahuddin, that we almost did a whole show during the break. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. And when you were last here, we talked about what Sherman is and that it's basically, you know, it contains multitudes. The Sherman in Africa episode, which has a throwaway line about cultural imperialism and colonialism, about language that...
You don't want to give it away, though.
I don't want to give it away, but I'll put it this way. If I were you, I would never go to Senegal again. How about that? So much of this is about, especially on Sherman's behalf, egomania and pettiness. It's interesting that this is a through line between these two shows, people wanting to be heard. I mean, that's what this whole season of Southside is about. So much so that it ends up being mirrored in pop culture in a bigger way by the last episode. And I'm not going to give too much away about that either. But talk to me about this idea of people wanting to be seen and heard, which is so integral to what you guys do together.
Well, I think that when we first started off in this business, there was what we felt sort of something missing out there. Like there were, you know, there were camps, right? Like there were camps of, you know, this filmmaker has a certain style and these comedians over here, they make a certain type of show. But we didn't really see the kind of material that we thought we could do. And it took quite a few years to convince Hollywood that we had a different voice and a different POV. So I do think that, you know, that probably comes through in our characters more than I'm even aware, you know, this idea of, you know, we really want to be heard, because I think for years and almost a full decade, we felt like we couldn't be heard. We felt like, you know, we were either going to have to staff in someone else's room and try and maybe steer their voice in our direction, or we were going to have to adopt someone else's voice. Thankfully, with the explosion of streamers, we had the chance to put two shows out there that I feel are not the same. I love the fact that these shows don't feel like they came out of the exact same kitchen, but they do represent two sides of what we find funny. One is Sherman Showcase. It's a very heightened world. It's very full of lore. You know, like I love the season finale of Sherman's where we explain why Sherman doesn't age. Well, the lore doesn't change. No, believe it or not, I'm sort of like a walking Bible on Sherman's because I kind of remember everything. And we try not to contradict themselves. Obviously, every now and then, some astute viewer will send me a DM or a tweet saying, hey, I noticed the Dutch wore glasses in 2016, but then he's wearing the eye patch again in 2017. And so then we do an entire sketch to explain away why that is the case, which I won't say which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, somebody calling us out or if it was planned, but I want all of it to sort of track like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I always said the Sherman Showcase was like the Marvel Cinematic Universe of Black music to me. So I want all that stuff to track. And trust me, Questlove and other super fans of that show, they will call me out. They will actually call me and say, hey, is the reason why Dutch is not the producer of Sherman Showcase in 1980, is that a Lorne Michaels reference to SNL? I mean, like, I'm so happy that we can throw the smallest Easter egg into both shows and people catch up on it. There's an episode of Southside where someone walks in with a box of something called Sherman's Donuts and people called it out. And I love that about it.
One of the things I want to say to you, and I said this to you when we met, is that there is still a paucity of Black perspectives in comedy. It's still more or less monolithic. There are two or three types of tropes that are trotted out. But to offer comedy that is both funny and referential, not reverential, but referential simultaneously, is not something that happens very often. It's a given in mainstream comedy, but the idea that there is a broad and hungry knowledge of Black popular culture is this peculiar sort of thing that people look upon as being, I think, mythological rather than real.
I'm of two minds, which is that on the one hand, I don't like our jokes to be too referential. You know, sometimes I feel like that can be used in certain settings as a crutch. But I think if it's the right reference, or if it's just a really unexpected, I haven't heard that before reference, then I'm all for it. Just this morning, I almost put in the line because a concert promoter was worried that the band hadn't shown up. And he says, and the line as written was, Fab Five Freddy told me everybody's late. You know, like little nuggets like that really make me chuckle. But I will say, aside from that, you know, one person that we really love is Issa Rae. We've known each other since before even Insecure debuted, going back to the Awkward Black Girl days. And I remember she asked me to be on an episode of Insecure, just acting. And after we shot the script, she does what we tend to do on our shows, which is, hey, let's do one where we, you know, don't worry about the script and just play the character and let's see where it goes. And I remember at one point I referred to Tupac as the Nikki Giovanni of hip hop. And everybody kind of broke character and laughed at that. And it's one of those things where you kind of have to know what the scene was about and what the moment. But I think that, like, yes, I think that we tend to try and bring in different references almost than most people will bring in, just because our life experiences, you know, I'm the son of a painter and Bashir is the son of a imam. And we were just raised with sort of almost an outsider's perspective, even within the Black community, sort of my agnostic upbringing and his Muslim upbringing. You know, we were sort of immediately sort of a little bit of an outsider just because we weren't going to church every Sunday. You know, we weren't the PK kids. Shout out to the PK kids, by the way, preacher kids. You know, I think that when we met at Harvard, you know, Bashir and I, we actually met in the gospel group, which is the great irony. We religion brought us together, but we were singing gospel primarily from, you know, we like these songs point of view. And then we figured out that we both loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure and the Muppets and the Simpsons, like I said. And from that shared sense of humor, sort of all other things sort of flow.
By the way, we're talking about flow with my guest, Diallo Riddle, who co-produces and creates and co-stars in the shows Sherman's Showcase and Southside. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. When we're talking about these things, too, I can't help but think that the idea of lore coming from all these things you're talking about, that the Muppets are steeped in its own lore, and so is the Simpsons. These places that create these worlds, and these worlds that kind of have these their own laws of physics and their own character laws, and you know who people are as soon as you meet them, which is also something that's really crucial to the way you guys work, is that as soon as we see a character, and that's why one of the things I love so much about Southside, going back to even that first episode with the snow cone guy, is on that show, people's hair identifies them immediately. We know who somebody is just from the hair.
We could not invent that guy's hair, by the way. I think that's one of the first things that you'll know. Like, all props to my hair department. You cannot invent that. I would not have thought to write that into a script. I think there's something so wonderful about authentic people. But can I just say, I think that you've hit one of my favorite things about Southside, which is, when we bring in actors, and again, we don't really fly actors in from New York and LA for that show. We do almost all of our casting, almost literally every person lives in Chicago, and the majority of them live on the South Side. If somebody comes in and has one line in the script, but we think they're really funny, we definitely bring them back to play that same character. It may not have been written as that same character, but we'll bring that same actor back so long as it doesn't step on the idea that that's the same person. So, for example, there is a woman in the line for Harold's Chicken in episode 9 of season 1 who really made us laugh. So when we wrote the character of a mom on the street in season 2, we were like, hey, why don't we bring her back? Does that track? Yes, she could definitely be the same character in line at Harold's Chicken and be the woman who's worried about, you know, people harassing her kid in season 2. It's weird if they're the shoe salesman and a police officer. That seems like a big jump. So we kind of go out of our way, but there's one actor who I thought, you know, maybe in season 4, we'll just track his whole entire day. He's played a pizza guy. He's played a vendor at the White Sox game. he has, you know, he keeps popping up. And I was like, none of this stuff contradicts itself, but I totally would just love to follow this one character as he interacts with our entire cast over the course of, you know, 24 hours. Like, that's the sort of fun and devil may care attitude that we take with scripting and casting the show.
But also part of the fun too is that there are so many people in all of these things. And so often when the show is trying to create a world, it's kind of so specific that there's only a handful of people in it. But that you guys are so skillful about juggling persona and bringing actors back. I mean, just watching all the different things that Thomas Dobson does as a dancer and these characters and seeing a chance to see him like do these things and sort of seeing the pleasure he gets in it. That's the thing that sort of comes across too, is these people respond to being given so many different kinds of things to play.
I think Tommy Hobson is a perfect example. First off, just an amazing actor. He went to Yale Drama, full disclosure. I mean, like, ironically, we met him because our kids liked him on a kids show, and we went to see their live performance, and we went backstage and introduced ourselves. And my wife is a choreographer. She's actually the choreographer for Sherman Showcase. They really hit it off. And then next thing you know, it was like, hey, Tommy, do you want to play one of the showcase dancers, which is our version of like the Solid Gold dancers? And he was like, absolutely. So as he became one of our dancers, I come to know him as like this amazing, talented actor who can kind of do anything. And he kind of, I will say, when you cast a good actor, it inevitably saves you money, you know, because they're not going to give you a bad take. You're not going to have to do 8 takes to try. He did an amazing take for the Black History special for Sherman Showcase, where we were literally short on time, and we go to him and we say, hey, Tommy, we need you to play the last, you know, Ty Mac, aka the last dragon in this scene. And that wall is made of paper. We have just enough time to shoot this scene once, so we need you to break through the wall of paper, say your line, and then break out the other wall of paper. We have time to do this exactly once. And I'll never forget, he came in, he nailed it, and like everybody cheered. And I was just like, if he had flubbed even just one line, maybe we would have been able to fix an ADR. We didn't have to do that. He's amazing. Tommy Hobson, just one of the many talented actors who I love the fact that I get to give him a platform. You know, because I do feel like the dancers on Sherman Showcase, almost all of them are really, really strong comedic actors. And part of what I just love to do when I wake up in the morning is give, you know, talented artists a chance to shine. It's one of the best things about my job.
Well, one of the best things about this job is I get to talk to you again. Diallo, thanks again. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Diallo Riddle writes, co-stars, co-produces, and co-created two wildly different and equally funny comedy series, Southside for HBO Max and Sherman Showcase on IFC. Ambitious swings in comedy and drama can be found on past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Happy 2023. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You're listening to The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time I saw Todd Field, we were talking about some elements that may have resurfaced in his new film, Tar, his third film of the 21st century, we should say, as writer-director. He was last year for his film, Little Children, the last film that he made. So thank you for coming back by. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Elvis.
First of all, I'm so happy you're here. The movie's astonishing. And it does so much of the stuff texturally that I associate with you, which is basically treating everything as if it's kind of a thriller and throwing us into the center of the ring with the central figure.
And this really feels like that to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess there's probably something consistent in terms of approach on these three films that's not conscious in my part at all. But there is that, yeah, the idea of sort of torquing, finding a character, putting them in a situation, torpedoing it, and then just torquing that. I probably respond to on many levels, and not the least of which is as a viewer.
But also these films, too, are about so this compiling information for us, as viewers, you're offering up this sort of constancy of clues. Mm. And I think that really comes to pay off by the end of the film.
I've always sort of been interested in the sort of get in late, get out early kind of storytelling where context is king. So no scene in and of itself makes any sense without all of the other scenes. There's no strictly equational scene in and of itself, or if you think that there is, you might change your mind about it after seeing it in a larger context.
I guess I should ask you at this point, for people who haven't seen the film yet, to explain to them what Tar is all about.
Well, Lydia Tar is many things, as Adam Gopnik would say, some of which are pieces of self-construction, hyperbole, some of which are real, some of which are utter fabrications. But in terms of what the film is about, you have a sense of what a film is about when you build it, when you write a script. That tends to evolve as you're shooting and you're collaborating, in this case with someone as formidable as Cate Blanchett. All these actors, very smart artists, very smart filmmakers themselves come in and the thing grows. And then you really think, oh, okay, that's what this thing is, you know. And then you get into post. In this case, we had a very aggressive schedule. There are only a few scenes that are repetitive locations where you camp out for a week or so. But mostly we had company moves every day. So there was very little time. And we worked 7-day weeks and I never watched any dailies. So there's the impressions that you're given, you know, in the moment as you're trying to get through your day. And then there's the sort of impressions that you have when you're sitting alone with your editor, in this case, Monica Willey, watching something like it's a proctology exam, you know, and just saying, oh, you know, and again, seeing it in a run in context and actually seeing the elegance of what, in this case, you know, Cate Blanchett has done to track that performance in terms of taking that precision and deciding when the wheels are going to come off and tiny little invisible things that she does in this performance that you could really only appreciate without having, you know, 300 people behind you and wondering where the trucks are going to be parked. Like just sitting alone in Scotland, every day, Mona and I would turn to each other and just go, did you see that? Look what she's doing there. You know, things that you had never spotted before. And you start to see a pattern, you know, and just in terms of her score of physical actions, just the most exquisite little moves that she makes in this. So this is a long digressive way of saying, I can't tell you what the movie's about. Because the film, you know, really, and this is true, every, you know, we would get to a point where we'd watch it in a run and Mona and I would turn to each other and I'd say, how do you feel about her today? And she'd say, well, I don't know. I didn't like her very much today. And then she'd say, how did you feel? And I say, I don't know. I'm sort of indifferent about her today. You know, and then 3 days later, we'd watch it again in a run and I'd say, how did you feel about her today? And she'd say, well, I don't know. There was a moment where I kind of admired her today. I said, okay, when was that? Well, when she got up at the podium at the end. I liked her posture. She had a sense of ownership there. She was still going to make music. How did you feel today? I said, oh, I didn't like her at all today. You know, and so it really changed, you know, and it was built for that purpose. You know, it was built as a sort of, what's Brecht's quote? It's, you know, art is not holding up a mirror. It's, you know, breaking something and turning it into a hammer kind of thing. And it was really meant to be a tool for the viewer, not necessarily a reflection of intent.
It's a treat. We're sitting with our old friend Todd Field, who's finally made another movie, the film Star. You can also get the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. As you were talking about that, one of the things that struck me, and there's so much, obviously, but thinking about how she's tailored at the beginning of the movie, by the end, she's wearing these big, shapeless clothes and more in touch with things, just because things are flowing around her rather than constricting her. But also, she's not in control of those rooms anymore because for the very first half of the movie, she not only doesn't seem to have a home, but she's able to sort of make everybody else feel the same discomfort that she feels. And that's a really striking thing in all these environments, all these beautifully manicured rooms where everything is clean and we can see every surface around us and even the ceilings you're showing us in there. this control and the sense of dislocation simultaneously, which is a wondrous thing to watch. And there's an early scene, which is, I think, such a masterful piece of directing, where you realize at the end of it, it's been 10 minutes of her conducting this room, complete with the one person's knee moving like a metronome, so we're aware of the count and the musicality of the conversation and the stops and the glottal pauses. That's a musical piece.
She's not just controlling the room and the people in it. She's controlling us, because Mona and I have no control over the editorial. The only control we have is in terms of the blocking, in terms of saying, okay, there's going to be 36 camera setups here, but they're all going to be in a single take, you know, and that hopefully we don't get caught. Like, we're going to need a wide master here. We're going to need an over the shoulder here, a two shot, a detail shot. This is going to be a slide tracking shot into a raking shot, without hopefully being aware of it, being involved in her propulsion, so that as she changes her tempo and as she changes her tactic and as she gets more aggravated at her failure, she can determine how she spends those 10 minutes.
In some ways, she's her own kind of Patricia Highsmith character. And that's what it felt like to me. That sense of invention we get from Highsmith characters, that ambition to be something different, not necessarily better, but just different.
That's a really interesting analogy, because I do think there is that kind of Ripley thing in her, for sure, especially when she goes back to her Staten Island home at the end. And that's a really sort of Highsmith kind of moment, sort of in reverse, the way you get it in Ripley. That's sort of front loaded. You know where he's coming from. You know what the dilemma is for him in terms of his crisis or his appetite.
In the interview, and I was really transfixed by this, that sort of sense of basically even controlling the interview, the awareness of turn of phrase, and just that sense of that desperation for control really sent me. I went and reread Ripley's Game after this, because I just wonder if these were obvious sort of touchstones for you, because they certainly were for me in the watching of it.
Not consciously. I mean, I'm certainly steeped in Highsmith, but no, not at all. I mean, the main thing was that section, that front section with Adam Gopnik was a real commitment on all of our parts, and it had to do several things. You know, one of the things was you had to realize that it was self-constructed, and you get that through her assistant Francesca Lentini, who's actually, you know, lip syncing with Adam. So you know that what he's trotting out for her came through the sieve of she, her assistant, and probably a huge PR team. But it's being stated as fact, and it's being stated as fact, and it's going in the record, and it's winding up in the New Yorker. And then all of a sudden it is fact. It's part of who she is. And it wasn't written by Adam. It wasn't written by a reporter at the New Yorker. It was written by her. And she sort of collected these things over the years in terms of her self-construction, absolutely.
As with Highsmith, when those characters are forced to actually put their feet on the ground, almost in any case in Highsmith, when those people have to go outside and things are beyond their control. And that's the sense we got here. That's why, again, I keep bringing up thriller and mystery, and not in the conventional sense, but just because of this unraveling of a character, because that's in effect what's happening. She is playing a character, and she's losing the thread of that character.
That's exactly right. Yeah, she's playing a character that she's written herself, and she can't play it anymore. You know, she can't play it anymore for whatever she's done, noises off that we don't know about. She can't play it anymore because she's reaching an age, you know, 50, she's middle-aged, and she's sort of reached the top of this cultural bureaucracy that's sort of fed through, you know, winks and nods and political concerns that are sort of navigated through logic, taste, capriciousness, hypocrisy, you know, all of these sort of messiness of human behavior. But it's far afield from whatever that is that drove her into playing music in the first place as a young person. It's very different. There's a lot of different things at play, and most of them have to do with the construction of power lines and how is that transmitted and who benefits from it and who doesn't. What are the rules of that? You know, the classical music milieu is very much like academia, which is it informs our lives in such a really deeply fundamental way. But both things are hermetic and are outside of life, and they have their own rules, and they have their own social mores, and they have a whole language that anyone outside of them wouldn't necessarily understand or be able to navigate.
Your films as often has not been about characters attempting to present themselves in one way and being thwarted in that idea that at some point they look at themselves in the mirror and see that they're not the person they think they are.
wonder what that conversation was to have with Kate Blanchett about that recognition that she's not who she thinks she is.
You know, I had met Kate 10 years ago. Joan Didion and I we'd written a script together, and we very much wanted Kate to do it. And I met with her in New York for a couple of hours, and I walked away from that meeting so struck by the fact that I had a conversation with this formidable intellect who was a filmmaker in their own right. I mean, the way she looks at narrative is not necessarily a typical way that you would expect from a performer, because she's so much more, you know. So, you know, when she said yes to this, our conversations, we were supposed to go immediately into Berlin, and there had been a second lockdown. So we had to punt for a year because I wanted it to be in November, and I wanted to have a lot of negative flat light outside, which meant that we have to start in the interiors in September and work our way back. So we lost a year, but we didn't lose a year, because in that year, she made two other films, and she'd come home from work at night and start getting to work. She was in Europe, so the time zone was very good for us. So she would call me, and we'd work on all kinds of practical things having to do with both the character. I mean, if we weren't in dialogue, she would be working on her beat technique, or she would be taking piano lessons or German lessons or all of these things. So she had much to say. And as much as I was able to gleam, you know, in my preparation for the script, she met and surpassed that in terms of her knowledge. Like, she probably learned more about concert music and all of the attending important things that this character would know in a year than the character herself would have learned in 25.
Again, back to Highsmith, because Ripley was a collector of other people's things.
That's very true.
And he was constantly going through his pockets, finding a button from somebody he'd killed or something that he collected from someone. And that obsessive quality, these items are totemic.
Yeah, they are. There is something about, you know, there are all kinds of versions of psychopaths. And I remember years ago being in Toronto with my first film and having a drink with Tom Wilkinson afterwards. And he said he'd just read a story about a psychopath that was like in the Globe or something like that, one of the papers up there. And it really struck me. And I was desperate to try to find it, because the way he told the story was so captivating. And I thought, ooh, that's really, really interesting. And what it was a psychopath being interviewed and trying to explain to you what it is. And essentially what this person said was, we're not born the same way, but we have to survive. And the way in which we survive is to act. They gave an example of walking down the street and coming across a terrible car accident. And there was a mother over a child just weeping, just, you know, just mourning the child, screaming the child. And the psychopath going back home, going immediately into the bathroom, locking the door and getting in front of the mirror and trying to make those faces and trying to make the sounds of the mother and then catalog it and keep it. And it was I thought, very novel way of looking at, you know, a psychopath, because we have other ways that typically we're meant to think about them as monsters and all these things, as opposed to somebody that's simply born without a tool, you know, doesn't have the tool of empathy and doesn't able to read social cues and all those things, and ultimately having to construct themselves to live in the world.
It's the truth. My guest was referring to an earlier movie, In the Bedroom with Tom Wilkinson, is Todd Field's new film as writer-director is Tar. You can also see the show at kcrw.com. But I did find myself thinking so often about that moment where these characters kind of brought up short. But this, the entire first half of the movie is about this. So incrementally, talk to us constructing that, because that's a really daring thing to do. Just to say, I'm going to really take my time with this and show that her falling apart, tighten the camera lens, because she's already basically destroyed, but she's still got this shell of construction around her. It's a veneer to keep the world at bay.
She keeps us at arm's length for a very long time. So we have this very long scene, you know, the introductory scene at this New Yorker talk with Adam. Then we have a scene with her with her patron, who's this investment banker come amateur conductor who funds her organization for young female conductors. So on one side, you get this very impressive performance from her with Adam. And the next time you see her and you see she's kind of clearly doesn't want to spend time with this person. It's an obligation. And then you see her in the classroom and it feels like, oh, she's coming alive now. She's rolling up her sleeves. And she's a very different character in that setting. and she can't keep her powder dry. And you say, oh, okay, she's capable of losing control. And then she comes home with her partner. And we know that there's that she's lying to her about something fundamental having to do with her partner's demise. You know,
and she's also not looking at her.
And she's not looking at her. And she smooths her down. She's given a task about having to do with family, and she can't be bothered with it. And she wants to deal with it quickly as opposed to maybe in a more healthy fashion. So she goes after a child in the schoolyard. But it's not until she's actually standing in the bathroom and she's brushing her teeth where you say, oh. For me, that's always my favorite moment in the film because I feel like I've suddenly been granted a wish where I have real access to someone. Like, okay, she's not a robot. She is a human being. You know, she looks tired. She brushes her teeth. She goes to the bathroom. You know, her hair is disheveled. And so it's really a very, very long setup, as you say, looking at her through very different lenses based on who she's with. Until we have any kind of real personal proximity or access to her.
It's a movie that demands several views just to watch it, to watch her, and then to go back and watch everybody else reacting to her. And then to understand how by the end, the last third of the movie, where things are completely out of her control, I should say incrementally. Tom, I'm trying to talk about this in ways without giving things away.
No. I mean,
it's hard.
It's hard because, well, the point of view is fairly objective. You know, we start and it could be almost Elizabethan, like
I think it is Elizabethan.
A soldier walking on, looking at the king asleep, and you're wondering, and they're deciding whether they're going to put a dagger in the king's sleeping belly or not in the forest, you know. But mostly it's objective with the exception of really two points of views that the audience has access to. One, the first one being her assistant, played by Noemi Merlant, Francesca Lentini, who is always watching her. So we get to sort of try to read her through Noemi's eyes. But when she leaves, and she does leave at a certain point, that feeling sort of really passes to her partner, Sharon Goodnow, played by Nina Haas. And that was really important because, you know, when Nina came on, she said something to me really, it changed everything. She said, I really want to make this film with you guys, but I think there's something you might do a little differently here. It's here, but I think we need to really examine it, which is Lydia Tarr is not there by herself, and Lydia Tarr isn't allowed to do the things she does by herself. There's a complicity with Sharon, and Sharon holds a great deal of power because she's a concertmaster of this orchestra and, in fact, has much more power than Lydia herself because the principal conductors are voted in. It's a democracy. So they're a power couple. And that power couple forms a third entity that's allowed to do all kinds of things. And there is a cost benefit for Sharon, but she's no wilting violet. She's not a victim at all. She, as long as it's good for business, she kind of plays along. And so we have access to her in that way too.
It feels pretty demanding to me to watch. And I wonder what it feels like to you in terms of putting it together this way. And I know you're saying that Cate Blanchett is your partner in all of this and your collaborator, I should say, your co-conspirator. But how much in terms of constructing of it as a piece of writing? Because, that very last scene and that camera move, it's a really beautiful payoff for all of this.
This was an unusual situation, which is people don't tend to hire you to write unless there's a reasonable sort of set of circumstances, those being normally intellectual property that they have control over, you have control over, so that people kind of know what you're doing. This was a situation where, as my friend John Franzen would say, you know, you get to have fun, which was, it was the beginning of March 2020, and Peter Kujawski basically said, we don't care what you do, write whatever you want. We just want to make a film with you. And that was incredible because there was nothing other than this character who I'd been thinking about for about 10 years. And I thought, oh, okay, now she gets to come out of the...
Always in this context?
Never in this context, just as an entity. She could have been anything. She could have been sitting at the head of a, you know, major corporation or an energy company, anything. I'm probably the worst person to analyze intent behind the construction. It certainly was there. But I was really just kind of finding my way, you know, and that normally starts with rules. Like when you have IP, there are the rules you're either going to adhere to or make war with and break when you're adapting material. But if you're starting with whole cloth, you have to make rules. What are the rules for this? You know, and the rules for me were really simple, which is we're only allowed to know what the points of view know. So when the film begins, whoever's watching her, that's a point of view. We're allowed access to that point of view. If it's an objective point of view, it's going to be on her, and we're only going to experience what she experiences. If she's going to be investigating something, we only see what it is that she's looking at, whether she's looking at an email or anything else. But we weren't allowed to have information that she or whoever's watching her would not have. That's a fairly, you know, it's a very simple set of rules. But if you adhere to those rules, what follows is essentially that kind of construction in terms of information you're allowed to have and information that you either have to intuit, or you have to augment for yourself, or you have to make judgments, or you have to ask yourself, am I allowed to make judgments because I don't have enough information here? And in that way, hopefully the audience is the final filmmaker, and they get to bring whatever they have to finish the film. And that's confusing for some people, and they won't want to do it because it requires a very different kind of attention. But I think that if you do, then your interpretation of the film is all that matters. And what I have to say is, you know, is beyond irrelevant.
We're out of time, so I guess this is a good place to end as any. But, you know, it leaves as many questions unanswered as the movie does. So I can't thank you enough, Todd. It's always great talking to you. Make another movie in the next 12 years, why don't you?
All right, thanks, Alfred.
I guess Todd Field, his newest terrific film as writer-director, is Tar. Something new from writer-director Todd Field. Tar, the tour de force performance from Cate Blanchett, now in theaters. Previous interviews with Todd Field and Diallo Riddle and others are available to you at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and it's The Treat. Comedian and former Saturday Night Live cast member Chris Redd knows suffering, as his recent HBO Max special, Why Am I Like This, showed us. And he shows us something else with his treat, how falling asleep with another sufferer's words in his head eased his torments.
What's going on, y'all? I'm Chris Redd, and this is The Treat. One of the things that inspired me the most throughout my entire life is Richard Pryor. Nobody wants you when you're down and out. I started listening to his tapes when I was maybe like 5 or 6. My dad had a bunch of Richard Pryor in the house, and we were not allowed to listen to it. We were a church-going family. But I was had a lot of insecurity. I had a lot of social anxiety. And so I had to figure out how I was going to talk in front of people. And I stuttered on top of that. And comedy was seemed like a way to engage with people and engage with girls. You know, it just seemed like a way in, because I was just terrified to talk to people at that age and at the time.
I'm telling you something. I got so nervous myself today. I forgot what the I did. I was at home. I said, I know I do something, because there's too many white folks paying attention to me for me not to be in jail and
And I was asleep to like his specials, because I was like, because I had read somewhere that if you sleep, like whatever you listen to in your sleep, it will like affect you when you wake up, you know. So I was like, oh, if I listen to a funny when I go to bed, I'm going to wake up with funny. You know, so I would just listen to every one of his albums, and the way he would use all his personal life and the way he was so vulnerable about these dark things that made me feel better about the things I was going through.
I'm talking about, it's an addiction. It's a monster. It's pitiful, because I end up on the floor looking for at my house. I'm like, oh, let me smoke this and be a piece of log or anything. Wonder how my sleeve would taste.
As we get to middle school and high school, and like I'm having these issues and these problems, and the way he just laughed at his pain, and I was, it just really inspired me to to be creative with my pain in the same way.
And you know something I found out? When you're on fire and running down the street, people will get out of your way. Except for one old drunk, right? He's going, hey, buddy, can I get a light? How about just a little off the sleeve, one, okay?
Richard didn't hold no punches, man. Like, you know, even when he was getting roasted for being on crack and roasted for all this other shit, like, and he did his own, he did a joke about himself in the Sunset where he's talking about this Richard Pryor running down the street, like with his hair with the match on fire. It was just like, man, nothing's off limits, and nobody can come at you and say anything that affects you if you can look at yourself and have the self awareness.
Taking all my friends up. For real good time, my champagne whiskey, bootleg wine.
But I that level of vulnerability and using that really helped me a lot. It just showed that there's really no mistakes in life, only experiences that you can utilize to tell your story. And cause I used to think about like all the things I used to do running the streets, and it's like all that was wasted time. But now I'm making like art off of the experiences I've been through, and it's all because I looked up to people who did it better than me, you know.
Pain is in my heart, stand me behind, yeah.
Oh, yeah. From live on the Sunset Strip to live from New York, comedian Chris Redd on the genius of Richard Pryor. Redd's latest, the HBO Max special, Why Am I Like This? Living at the Treat, past editions, including Tyler Perry, on a friend of his, Oprah Winfrey. If we can't be friends with Oprah, here's the next best thing, Why It Matters. The Treat gives us a chance to hear what matters and why it does. Inspiration from some of the most important figures in popular culture. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. Katie Gilchrist mixes it, and we had help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan. To a better year, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.